Greetings, listeners. Welcome to the Cold Fusion Now podcast, where we bring you the latest developments in the science, engineering, and business of Cold Fusion Leonard. I'm your host, Ruby Carrot. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Mahadeva Srinivasan, a nuclear physicist and former head of the Neutron Physics Division at the Bhabha Atomic Research Center in Mumbai. Since retiring in 1997, he has consulted privately. In 2015, Dr. Srinivasan was a guest editor, along with Andrew Muhlenberg, for a special Leonard issue of the Current Science Journal, which summarized the state of knowledge in the field. He is speaking with us today from Chennai, India. Dr. Mahadeva Srinivasan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me on your show. It's a great pleasure. I'm looking forward to exchanging views and conveying to the others what's happening in India.
Well, let's do that. Talk first about what is happening in India. After some years of inactivity, it seems you have jump-started several research groups into a variety of experimental directions. How many groups are researching, and what is the focus of their work?
Well, as you rightly put it, it has been a one-man battle for me to try and revive the cold fusion research in India ever since it was sort of shut down way back in 1991-92, primarily because of the very negative publicity given to the DOE panel finding or conclusion that there is no evidence for cold fusion LENR. Unfortunately, as you very well know, this has been a very unfortunate development in the history of LENR. And I can, many other countries, including, of course, the U.S., in India, too, people took that pronouncement of the Department of Energy's IRAP panel seriously and decided cold fusion doesn't have a basis. So it has been difficult, and especially because I had retired by then, by 1997, but luckily, almost 25 years later, when the new government in Delhi, the BJP government under the present Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, came to power, I had the opportunity to reach out to the new government and try to get them interested. I must admit that I had to resort to approaching the political class, given the highly negative response of the scientific community to the whole subject. So that was what really triggered interest. As I had mentioned before to you on other occasions, I had the opportunity to meet the Minister for Power in the federal government in Delhi, Mr. Piyush Goyal, who took interest, and he enabled, shall we say, a re-examination or trying to bring fresh people into the fold. He made available funding from the Ministry of Renewable Energy, and that made possible for us to hold an initial meeting at the National Institute for Advanced Studies. So all this helped. We were able to get together in a single room some of the major scientific groups in India. We tried our best to convince them, here is a field that deserves to be given attention, and so on. But I'll let you ask the questions. And this is what triggered fresh interest. But having said that, I must also add I am a little bit disappointed that I could not have a bigger response. Although the scientists, many representatives of the Indian Institutes of Technology and some of the national laboratories, the scientists showed interest, but we did not succeed in obtaining funding from the federal government. In India, that's the only source of major funding for scientific research, and there it has not been possible to get the funding released, although the people are showing interest. So to summarize, to answer your immediate question, we have four groups working in India today, and so I guess I should be happy at least we have four groups now as compared to zero, which was the situation for the past 25 years.
Yeah, I think you could be happy with four groups. I know that we've seen some pictures of cells in the 2017 Lunaria calendar as well as the 2018 Lunaria calendar. Can you talk about how the experiments that they are doing today are similar and different from the experiments you performed in the early 1990s? I understand both of you are used nickel and light hydrogen. How are they different, and what kinds of things are they looking for?
Well, that's a good question. When we embarked on cold fusion in 1989, and as you probably know, we jumped in within 24 hours, worked at the Baba Atomic Research Center, started on the morning of the 24th of April, after we saw a little four-line news item in the Indian newspaper. So it was indeed exciting. We were fortunate at that time that the then director of the Baba Atomic Research Center, Dr. P.K. Iyengar, was equally excited. He was a man with vision, foresight, open-mindedness. So he was able to gather within a period of a few days 12 independent groups to independently verify the Fleischmann-Pons effect. But those days, our emphasis was on confirming the nuclear origin of the phenomenon rather than the excess heat aspect. So in the first few years, very little excess heat measurements were done, but most of the groups were looking for neutrons and tritium those days. However, the present almost all the four, well, three out of four groups today, one at the Indian Institute of Technology in Bombay, as you mentioned. Then we have a group, a professor at IIT, Indian Institute of Technology, Kanpur. And there's a group at the Swami Vivekananda S. Vyasa University. Surprisingly, also this Vyasa University, although they are dedicated to yoga research, but the director is very excited by cold fusion. He has formed a group of people who are looking. So three out of four groups in India are actually trying to replicate a version of the Parkamov type of nickel powder experiments, exposed primarily to hydrogen, but they are likely to try with deuterium gas also. So this time, the focus is on excess heat rather than nuclear products. If they get massive amounts or measurable amounts of excess heat, chances are they will look for evidence of nuclear phenomenon, probably transmutation products. Although they do have, some of the groups do have an online gamma monitor or some of these other nuclear particle detector. The emphasis this time is on excess heat and replication of the nickel, the gas loading process.
Mm. Do you know if they'll be reporting any results at the conference this summer?
Well, we have encouraged them to think in terms of publishing, even if it is incomplete. My personal suggestion to them is it will be useful to the groups as well as the, shall we say, the rest of the world if they could report, even if they have preliminary results. Mm-hmm. So let us see. I'm hoping at least 2 out of the 4 groups will submit an abstract.
Mm-hmm.
2 or 3 also, maybe 3 out of the 4 groups may have enough results to submit at least an abstract.
Mahadeva Srinivasan, in 2015, you were a guest editor for the special Lenner issue of Current Science Journal. What did all the experimental results that you reported in that journal say about a model? Do you see any breakthrough in theory on the horizon?
Well, as you know, Dr. Andrew Muhlenberg was a co-editor, co-guest editor, and he had been living and working at the Indian Institute of Science for many years. So I think he has probably done more work on modeling this reaction along with Professor K.P. Sinha, who had already done. So these are the 2 groups in India who have actually published papers. Well, I shouldn't say 2 groups. Both of them have been working. Basically, 1 group, Professor Muhlenberg and K.P. Sinha, who have come up with this deep Dirac levels and, you know, whatever theories they put forward. So I don't think anybody else has bothered to look at the theory seriously. Although there are many theoreticians, India has a lot of researchers working on nuclear physics, nuclear theory. But given the, shall we say, suspicious approach to LNR, they haven't applied their attention very much to the theory.
What would you say are some of the most important experimental results that need to be considered when creating a model?
Well, from what little I have appreciated, it does appear that in the case of the palladium deuterium system, it's the production of helium-4 that seems to be dominating the whole phenomenon. And so the theoreticians have been primarily looking at the production of helium in the palladium deuterium system.
Mm-hmm.
However, in the nickel hydrogen system, I think there is not, as far as I know, there is no experiment which has reported measuring the production of helium. If at all, the only group who talks about the helium producing model is the group from Berkeley.
Oh, who
is
Brillouin?
Brillouin. They are the only people who talk about helium being the end product. But I don't think they have published any results confirming the production of helium in the nickel hydrogen system.
No.
So that's an open question. And the at least from the remarks made by, well, you know, the history of the nickel hydrogen system and how the Rossi reactor has sort of dominated the scene, although many people have not accepted his work very seriously. And that is a different story. But at least the impression given was that perhaps in the nickel hydrogen system, it is transmutations that could be the source of the heat.
Mm-hmm.
But that question is open. I don't think anybody has published a clear correlation between transmutation products and the excess heat, even though George Miley in the early days in his experiments did give some indication that that could be the source of excess heat. Anyway, that's a different story. It has not been answered. So the emphasis is right now, at least as far as the nickel hydrogen system is concerned, is let's try and first establish the excess heat production in a clearly confirmed manner, and then we can look for the source of the excess heat.
In your early experiments with nickel and light hydrogen, you found that heavy water sometimes works as well, and a mixture of light and heavy water can actually create the reaction.
Well, we did some experiments with, shall we say, enriched water. They may not be 100% or 99% heavy water. But as I said, there was no clear, at least in our experiments, we were not able to say in a confirmed manner whether deuterium works better than hydrogen. So, but at least we found tritium production in the nickel light water experiments, as well as nickel hydrogen gas loaded thin wire experiments. So to that extent, the production of tritium, however small it was, in a nickel hydrogen system, in a way points to the direction that the Brillouin people have been talking about. But all this is open. I think people are first trying to come up with a reproducible nickel hydrogen excess heat system, in which case they can then divert and, you know, spend more resources to get to the bottom of the nuclear reaction that is responsible for it.
Mahadeva Srinivasan, finally, talk to us about why this research is so important for the world.
Well, that is absolutely obvious, given the hunger and need for a clean source of energy for mankind, and given that all the other known sources of energy had their own problems. I usually, in my lectures, depict the whole energy scenario in the form of a diagram, a circle with four quadrants, and quadrant number one is fossil fuel, whose carbon emission has a climate change problem, and obviously that is not the best for mankind as it stands. Quadrant number two is renewable energy, which is picking up all over the world, showing a lot of promise. But unfortunately, renewable energy, especially solar thermal as well as solar photovoltaic cells, needs the sun to be shining. And that occurs only for 8 hours in a day. Therefore, for renewable energy to make an impact, you need battery storage with all its problems, investments, shall we say, energy cost in producing the battery components and so on. So although Elon Musk and others, and there is an effort to close the cycle using coupling new battery technology, solar technology, solar cells, I don't think that can answer the needs of the world. And of course, we have nuclear, much promises, but with all the radiation and the Chernobyl type accident problems and so on, and of course the long-term waste disposal problem, that too is not what they would say what the doctor ordered. So all the present sources, the three quadrants that I mentioned, have the problems. So world needs, there's absolutely no doubt that the world needs a clean source of energy, and most people are agreed it is coming. There is possibility of this happening. It is only a question of time. Nature doesn't open its secrets so easily. We are looking for that. I have absolutely no doubt there will be a breakthrough of a clean source of energy, but whether it will happen the next few years or the next couple of decades, I do believe it's going to be within a decade we will see a breakthrough. So the world needs it. It will come, and especially a country like India and China. I was hoping that there would be a working LNR reactor, just enough, a 1 megawatt reactor to feed one village in India. This is what I was hoping for. I had great hopes following the whole story of the ECAT, the Rossi reactor. And at that time, when we all believed that something interesting is happening, especially when a company like Industrial Heat, when an industrialist pumps in $100 million into the thing, we all believe there is real hopes. It's a different matter that has not worked, and we don't know exactly whether the Rossi reactor worked at all, or that's a different story. You know the whole controversy around it. Mm-hmm. But at least I think it did open up the possibility that such things can happen. And the success of the experiments coming out of Japan and some from Russia and so on. And that's one of the reasons why the groups, at least 3 out of 4 groups in India, are pursuing the hot cat kind of Parkamo experiments. And let us see how it comes. But I'm happy. And I think the physics behind LNR, the long-term impact of the implications of occurrence of nuclear reactions occurred, is much more important than the production of an industrial product. It may come, it may not come, although the world needs an industrial product. But even if it doesn't, LNR, the importance of LNR remains. It has opened up a brand new branch of nuclear science, which is going to have a much greater impact in the long term. Now, I would like to add, if I have a minute, can I add one question?
Of course.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, as you know, I had the opportunity to write a review paper on LNR transmutations in the year 2010-2011, thanks to the invitation by Stephen Privet. An article was published in the Wiley Encyclopedia, and it gave me an opportunity to dig into all the papers and write this review paper, from which I learned a lot in writing the review paper on LNR transmutations. Now, the interesting thing, up until that point, many of the people in the cold fusion field felt that there are now 2 types of reactions that can give rise to energy. Nuclear reactions, you have, of course, the D+D fusion going to helium-4, or the so-called transmutation. But recently, you may or may not be aware of a paper I presented at ICCF 20 on behalf of a colleague of mine, a friend of mine, an industrial friend of mine, who is operating an industrial scale ferrosilicon factory. And this gentleman has been reporting tons per day levels of production of iron and silicon, which could not be explained from the input feed. He feeds in silicon quartz as the input. He knows how many tons of silicon he'll get, but he's getting 25% more. One little point, if only this gentleman had measured the isotopic composition of the silicon and iron he produces. He produces tons per day, 4 tons or whatever per day of excess silicon and iron, but there is no equivalent or commensurate amount of energy. This was the most puzzling issue. Many people therefore felt he's mistaken. I've been dealing and talking to him for the past 20 years on this topic. This is a separate, this thing, it is written a little bit in the in that paper, which is published in the Journal of, you know, ISCMNS, Journal of Condensed Matter Nuclear Science. So this opens up the following question. Is it possible that transmutations can occur without the accompanying nuclear energy, or what I call the missing energy? Now, this throws a new spanner in the works. And this is what I mean by something mysterious and unknown in the whole LNR field. So transmutations do occur. Nobody, now look back the past 20 years, but nobody has established a clear correlation between energy production and transmutation. And this takes us to the allied field of alchemy, production of gold from mercury and so on. As you know, Texas A&M University under Bockris had conducted such experiments. But here again, if you look back in the history of alchemy and all that is reported, people have made several kilograms of gold, but it didn't blow up in their face. There was no energy production. So this is a new puzzle that is added to the LNR field, and I'm trying to get answers. Very controversial. So the question is, can transmutations occur or without the production of the energy that we expect? In other words, it's not that it doesn't produce energy. Where does energy go? There are many mysterious questions which I am trying to understand, but very few people have. But in our paper, we have referred to some very interesting, shall we say, associated studies. I don't have the time to describe it here, but for those who are interested in the puzzle of LNR transmutations without the apparent energy production. And we have given cross-references in the paper. So I would like the readers to ponder over this and say, now we have opened yet another, I think, puzzle. The critics, the theoreticians are likely to say, Srinivasan, chances are your friend Narayana Swami's observations are wrong. But a person who is operating a factory, can you make a mistake of 4 tons per day? Is it a way? How can you make such a mistake? Tons per level. So anyway, I leave it at that. Interesting. So we will see. It's sad.
Well, Dr. Mahadeva Srinivasan, I wish you much success in your work, and I hope to hear some positive results from all the groups working in India this summer. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Ruby, for giving me the opportunity to share my ideas. I've enjoyed being associated with LNR from day one. I've just crossed the age of 80, and I was hoping that we will see a working reactor in my lifetime. There's still a chance, so let's hope, and thank you once again.
We've been speaking with Dr. Mahadeva Srinivasan, a nuclear physicist and former head of the Neutron Physics Division at the Bhabha Atomic Research Center in Mumbai. He joined us from Chennai, India. The New Energy Research Community reports the latest at the 21st International Conference on Condensed Matter Nuclear Science, ICCF-21, being held in the Lawyer Student Center at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado, U.S. The conference runs this summer, June 3rd through 8th, 2018. Registration is now open at www.iccf21.com. Follow up with the New Energy World Symposium, June 18th and 19th, 2018, in Stockholm, Sweden. For more information, go to new-symposium.org. That's it for today. Find more episodes of the Cold Fusion Now podcast on our website at coldfusionnow.org and subscribe on iTunes. We can bring transformational change. Go to our page at patreon.com/coldfusionnow and pledge as little as $1 to join our effort. You can also donate direct through PayPal on our website at coldfusionnow.org. Until next time, I'm Ruby Carrot.